say is what we have to have right now is an end to the siege and an end to these attacks on civilians.
Guta, 400,000 people, Alia?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to say that the sort of United States war on terror and the language in which it was framed and the resultant and inevitable Islamophobia that came out of it has been a gift to these authoritarian rulers in the Middle East who've been able to use the exact same language, not only for international legitimacy, but also for domestic legitimacy. And, you know, when we talk about let's say a huge percentage of 400,000 are terrorists. The reality is the regime is not trying to use more surgical elements because its goal is not to root out only armed opposition. Its goal is to clean out the area and then through demographics sort of change what it looks like, what it looks like as to who surrounds them. And this is a tactic that the regime has been using since the 70s. When Hafez al-Assad came to power, he brought a lot of his supporters from the regions that he came from and brought them into Syria, into Damascus, into the capital, and had them live around him as a kind of barrier. And when you say when the violence ends, it depends on how you define violence. You know, we might see aerial bombardment stop, but the regime has used violence every single day in Syria. Its use of detentions, which we don't talk about as much because it's not as visibly violent, is how it has controlled, how it's remained in power. And this is part of the reason that so-called evacuees will not opt to come into regime-controlled areas. And this is the reason that refugees will not return from abroad. Because the threat of the violence of detention, arbitrary detention, where you basically disappear, will remain a constant.
Are foreign powers more interested in a proxy war or a ceasefire? You have Israel shooting down the Iran drone. You have the latest news on the Turkish border. Reuters reporting Syrian Kurdish YPG militia said today the fighters backing the Syrian government were deploying on the front line to help repel a Turkish assault.
What all of the international actors should be really concerned about at this stage is primarily the welfare of civilians. International law cannot be more clear. Direct attacks against civilians are unlawful and are a war crime. And what we need to be seeing is these civilians have lived through horrors upon horrors for the past 6, 7, 8 years. They have been deliberately targeted. They have been deprived of very basic necessities in order to survive. And these kind of behaviors and other actions supporting these kind of violations is what we should really be concerned about. How do we spare civilians this ongoing onslaught?
Hmm. And Wendy Perlman, your focus on the voices of the people of Syria. We will end there. The voices that need to be heard.
There are voices that are calling for primarily now an end to the war, an end to the violence. People want to be able to survive and live, provide for their children. So there needs to be civilian protection. I agree with my colleagues that this is the ultimate priority at this stage. But there's also a dream and a hope for freedom, for dignity, for a kind of political transition that allows Syrians to live under a system of rule of law, that protect basic rights, that allow them to speak without fear. Those political goals have not gone away, but first and foremost now, we need to protect civilian lives.
We're going to do part two of this conversation, post online at democracynow.org, and I'll just end by saying on Tuesday, the charity UNICEF released a nearly blank statement on the killings, writing, "No words will do justice to the children killed, their mothers, their fathers, and their loved ones." I want to thank our guests for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
It is 5:02, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the KBOO Evening News.
This is reporter and producer Grace Ann Smith, and you are listening to KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs here on your favorite authentically radical radio station, where you get to listen to real radio made fresh daily, 24/7, 365 days a year. KBOO keeps Portland and the Northwest radical by giving everyone the microphone. Go to your Kickstarter right now and pledge your support today so that KBOO can continue to give people with less visibility a larger platform. When you join the KBOO donor circle, your world becomes more interesting and real because of the different lived experiences you get to listen to. Donate to our Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio and While Rome Burns are proud to co-sponsor a concert with the Reverb Brothers and Metropolitan Farms to benefit Rose Haven on Sunday, February 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza and Pub in Portland. The Reverb Brothers play a blend of 30s jazz and blues, traditional country, New Orleans R&B, rock and roll, soul, their take on Americana. Metropolitan Farms play a mix between 80s college rock and pop, Britpop, and 70s West Coast rock. The show is a benefit for Rosehaven, which serves women and children experiencing the trauma of abuse, loss of home, and other disruptive life challenges. Again, that's the Reverb Brothers and Metropolitan Farms to benefit Rosehaven on Sunday, February 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza and Pub, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, you have 1 week left to get your pets fixed during National Spay and Neuter Awareness Month.
Mayor Ted Wheeler's texts land him in hot water.
And we'll have an update on how to stay warm in the cold nights ahead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. With weather remaining at or below freezing through tomorrow, the Multnomah County-run Joint Office of Homeless Services has announced it will guarantee homeless Portlanders will have a place to escape the cold, at least through tonight. City officials are calling for donations of winter gear to assist a homeless population that may have been left unprepared by this year's otherwise mild winter. Items that are particularly needed: thick socks, waterproof gloves or mittens, waterproof winter coats, men's and women's sizes, sleeping bags and warm blankets, water-resistant hats, knit caps, tarps, hand warmers, and rain ponchos. If you've got goods on hand, you can drop them off at Join, located at 1435 Northeast 81st Avenue.
Severe weather shelters open tonight at Bud Clark Commons, 655 Northwest Hoyt, Imago Dei, 1302 Southeast Ankeny, Sunrise Center, 18901 East Burnside, Gresham, and in a county building at 1415 Southeast 122nd. Most of those shelters have been at or near capacity on recent nights. They open at 8:30 p.m. A full list of resources is at 211info.org.
A report from the National Council on Disability reveals nearly one in three women with disabilities in college has been sexually assaulted. KBOO reporter Jasmine Moneymaker, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Nearly one in three women with disabilities on college campuses has experienced sexual assault. That's according to a new report from the National Council on Disability, an independent federal agency. The report, called Not on the Radar, also found colleges aren't prepared to respond to cases of sexual assault against students with disabilities. Wendy Harbor, an NCD member, says campuses should be thinking of disabilities the way they think of discrimination. She wants people to imagine what it takes to survive this situation and deal with the long process of reporting assault.
Now imagine a barrier at every single step of that process, and it's really placing an incredible burden on the student.
Harbor adds stereotyping of students with disabilities is widespread on college campuses and estimates that about 450,000 have been sexual assault victims. She also notes the study doesn't look at the college population. It includes only undergraduate women, not men, graduate students, or staff. State Senator Sarah Gelser of Corvallis is a former NCD member. She says the Oregon legislature has been working on ways to provide information to victims of sexual assault on college campuses, but that the issue is more complex for students with disabilities.
If you are deaf or hearing impaired, to be able to communicate that story to a confidential sexual assault advocate is incredibly difficult because you're often going to have to be doing that through a translator instead of directly face-to-face to the person that you need to help you.
Harbor says although the report reveals an epidemic of sexual assault on college campuses, the response from colleges has been encouraging.
The bad news is that disabled students are not on the radar of colleges related to sexual assault. The good news is that the report found that the minute disabled students were on the radar, colleges took action.
Harbor also says student-led groups are an effective way for students with disabilities to push for better policies and make sure their voices are heard. Jasmine Moneymaker, KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Text messages obtained by the Portland Mercury show the behind-the-scenes conversation between the mayor's office and the Portland Business Alliance that preceded the implementation of no-sit zones in the downtown business district in November. The texts were between Mayor Ted Wheeler, two members of his staff, and PBA President and CEO Sandra McDonough. They show what the Mercury calls, quote, striking differences, unquote, on the part of the mayor's office towards the PBA. The texts were exchanged 4 days after Columbia Sportswear CEO Tim Boyle wrote an op-ed in the Oregonian claiming his company was considering moving its flagship store out of the downtown because of safety concerns. The PBA had been pushing for widespread no-sitting areas for several years, often presenting a map with large swaths of downtown Portland marked off. Boyle's op-ed, written November 10th, clearly galvanized the mayor's office, which told McDonough on November 14th that it, quote, should have significant progress on your map by the end of the year, unquote. The city rolled out increased police patrols and new signs forbidding sitting on sidewalks on many, though not all, of the PBA's requested areas on December 2nd, prompting a protest that shuttered the Columbia stores for a day. The signs remain, though no further blocks have been added.
The Mercury also reports that the PBA was in contact with city officials 15 times between October and December last year regarding, quote, livability or homelessness or sidewalk management, among related topics. That's according to the auditor's lobbying activity reports. Many of these communications were from McDonough, who records show was also in contact with Wheeler's office and other commissioners about the same topics throughout 2017. The Portland Business Alliance donated $1,000 to Wheeler's campaign committee in December, according to the Oregon Secretary of State's office. That's after McDonough donated $250 to Wheeler in October, having given his committee $500 during the 2016 campaign. Since 2012, election year, McDonough has given money to nearly every city council member, including current commissioners Amanda Fritz, Nick Fish, and Dan Saltzman.
February is Spay-Neuter Awareness Month. Advocates across the country are working to raise awareness of the importance of spaying and neutering pets before the Spring Love Fest begins. As part of their effort, the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon has been offering free and low-cost sterilization services. KBOO reporter Jasmine Moneymaker spoke with Executive Director Karen Krause about what's on offer and the importance of getting cats fixed before the spring thaw.
You know, a lot of people think about springtime as kind of that reawakening of nature, and so you'll see birds having their babies and maybe baby bunnies, all sorts of animals. Spring is their main breeding season, and it's not different with cats. The season for them begins in the springtime as the days get longer and the weather gets warmer, so it's really important to spay and neuter feral and stray cats this time of year because they're spending all of their time outdoors, and if they haven't already been spayed or neutered, they're going to add to homeless cat populations living on our streets. And so it's really important now is that window before they have litters of kittens, that you can really make a dramatic impact for the whole year.
How big is the problem of stray and feral cats on the streets of Oregon?
Think about this. In our climate, cats can have up to 3 litters a year, and they can become sexually mature at 5 months of age. So it's easy in our climate for somebody to be feeding a cat in the spring and find themselves feeding 16 cats by fall if they didn't spay and neuter. And what we're finding throughout these years is that our message is reaching the folks, and we're not hearing from as many people with those larger numbers of cats because they got the help they needed before it reached that point. But it's not static. They're really good breeders, and we need everybody involved in making sure their pet cats are spayed or neutered, making sure if you're putting a bowl of food out in the backyard for a cat, or maybe where you work, you guys are feeding cats, make sure you get them spayed or neutered. They're not like wildlife where you can just put a bird feeder out. Really, it's important that you stop that breeding cycle because there'll be too many mouths to feed, and they're also homeless. They're living on our streets, and we definitely want better for our cats. It's not the right place for them.
World Spay Day is on February 27th, and in honor of that, your organization is offering free spay and neuter to feral cats and reduced prices to house cats. Can you tell us more about what you're offering and how our listeners can take advantage?
Yeah, so the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon offers donation-based spay and neuter for feral and stray cats throughout the year, and when you bring in a feral or stray cat, they not only get spayed or neutered, but we also will treat for ear mites if we see them. We'll treat for fleas. We give a rabies vaccine as well as a distemper vaccine. And we do all of that for a suggested donation of $30. However, we don't turn anyone away if they can't afford to donate. To really encourage people to get their cats spayed and neutered in February, which is Spay-Neuter Awareness Month and World Spay Day coming up on the 27th, we really promote it as free. Please, if you're feeding feral or stray cats, give us a call. We want to see you. We want to help you. We want to get those cats spayed and neutered and partner with you to make that happen. And so that's the biggest promotion that we have going on. And then in addition to that, we are offering reduced spay and neuter for people that are on public assistance or are low income and have pet cats that need to get spayed or neutered. And so they're going to get a reduced fee down to, it can be as low as $10 to get your pet cat spayed or neutered.
If I have a feral cat in my yard or, you know, around my house that I've been feeding or that is wandering around and I notice it, what's step one? Just to call your office?
You know, that is a great question, Jasmine. If you see a cat and you've never seen that cat before, if you're feeding the cat or not feeding the cat, talk to your neighbors. The number one first thing to do, talk to the neighbors. Same thing if you're maybe at a store or at a place of business and you see cats. Talk to the people who own the businesses. Find out who's feeding the cats. Because you can't really get involved unless you know that you're not trapping somebody's pet cat, right? So in your neighborhood, it's a great way to get to know your neighbors. You might find out that somebody new moved in and they're letting their cat outdoors. And guess what? He's getting fed at a bunch of houses, right? Or you might find out that that no one knows who this cat is and this cat has just shown up in your neighborhood, in which case they really do need your help. You feeding the cat is a good thing, but you got to get them spayed or neutered, and we're here for you. So talk to the neighbors, find out, because you definitely don't want to be the person that is feeding or taking in your neighbor's pet cat.
Okay, so step one is talk to the neighbors, and then step two, if it's not any neighbor's cat, then we should call you.
Yeah, give us a call, and we would be happy to walk you through how to utilize our services, including live traps. We've got great information. We teach people on a daily basis how to use these. They're basically box traps, live traps with a trip plate inside. The cats enter it and are humanely contained, and then you can bring the cat safely to our clinic where we'll spay, neuter, vaccinate, and then you will return the cat to where you're feeding the cat.
Karen Krause, Executive Director of the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon, thank you so much for your time and for the work that you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For more information on the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon Spay and Neuter Program, visit their website at www.feralcats.com, or you can call them at 503-797-2606. Jasmine Moneymaker, KABU News.
A joint investigation by the British publication The Guardian and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism found that 112 years after Upton Sinclair published The Jungle, U.S. meatpackers are still producing disgustingly contaminated meat. Swift Pork and Pilgrim's Pride chickens were found to be tainted with disease and feces. The journalists found pig carcasses piling up on the factory floor after an equipment breakdown, contaminating them with grease and blood. They found pus-filled abscesses in food destined for human consumption. Factory abattoirs were found to be particularly problematic as industrial processes such as spraying off conveyor belts spread bacteria and filth onto meat as it passed through the facilities. The study quotes Professor Eric Millstone of Sussex University, who says that outbreaks of infections and food poisoning are far more common in the U.S. than in Britain or Europe because of, quote, poor hygiene in the meat supply chain. The USDA, which is notoriously understaffed for inspectors, currently has recall notices out for products from A&A Finest, Nighthawk Frozen Foods, Pilgrim's Pride Corporation, Whip City Jerky, Rich Products Corporation, Purdue Farms, Crescent City Meats, and many others. The products are being recalled for various hygienic reasons, including undeclared allergens and listeria and salmonella bacterial contamination.
Human rights groups have denounced the State Department's plans to cut women's rights from its annual report. They say the decision is clear evidence that the rights of marginalized groups and are insignificant to the Trump administration. At the direction of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, department staffers are cutting passages regarding women's access to contraception and abortion, and how women's rights around the world are affected by their community's views on family planning. It will also cut a section regarding discrimination based on gender, race, and ethnicity. The document is expected to de-emphasize the effects of a non-government entity on marginalized groups around the world. In past years, the department's human rights report has covered incidents involving hate speech and hate crimes directed at religious and racial groups, as well as LGBTQ communities. But this is expected to be absent or nearly absent in this year's report.
Imprisonment for debt has become a part of the reality of U.S. working class. The American Civil Liberties Union has issued a new report titled A Pound of Flesh, which describes the manner in which debt collection firms have used the courts to put indebted Americans in jail. Debts become criminal cases when a summons is issued in a civil debt case, and the targeted person fails to appear. The ACLU reports that 77 million U.S. citizens are weighed down with debt. Civil court judges have issued warrants for failure to appear in debt cases in 26 states, including Oregon and Washington. The amount triggering an arrest warrant can be as little as $10. According to the report, corporations often use a false threat of arrest to collect debts. The ACLU notes in the report that a mother of three was arrested in front of her children for failing to keep up for payments for her treatments of thyroid cancer. Jennifer Turner, the author of the ACLU report, says the private debt collection industry uses prosecutors and judges as weapons against millions of Americans who can't afford to pay their bills. Strike Debt, an activist organization, is offering a free debt resistors manual to anyone worried about their debt on their website, strikedebt.org. That's STRIKEDEBT.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a KBOO interview with beloved local author Ursula K. Le Guin, who died a month ago today. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, a Native youth music and public affairs show featuring local and national Native issues and contemporary Native music. That's followed at 7 by Indigenous Power Hour. Then at 8, it's American Paradox Radio with host DJ Some Guy. Tonight's weather in the Portland metro area will be cloudy and cold, with a low near 20 degrees and winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1997, British scientists announced that they had successfully cloned a sheep. Dolly, the first clone of her kind, lived to be 6 years old before she had to be euthanized, leading many to question the success of the experiment. The quote of the day is from one of her creators, Ian Wilmot, who said, quote, "It's important to remember just what she did contribute. She made biologists think totally different about the ways cells develop for all of the different tissues. The experiments that led to her birth are one of the things that are making people think very differently about how to produce cells to treat Parkinson's disease and other unpleasant diseases."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The last year has been a roller coaster for healthcare policy as congressional Republicans fought to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on what tribal leaders are hoping for in 2018.
Despite numerous Republican attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, it's still the law of the land. However, Republicans have been able to chip away at it by removing the individual mandate, along with cutting some Obamacare outreach efforts. Dolores Curry is the Turtle Clan mother for the Piscataway Kanoi Tribe of Maryland. She says healthcare needs in Indian Country aren't political, they're tangible.
We have the diabetes, we have those who have glaucoma, we have those who have high blood pressure.
Curry says more funding is needed, and she doesn't like President Trump's proposal to cut Medicaid and Medicare.
We have Native families that make less than $15,000 a year. So how are they going to provide to be educated on health issues if they don't have money?
National and tribal leaders are trying to pressure lawmakers in Washington to pursue a number of different avenues to better distribute health care across the country. One of those is a controversial plan that would give tribal nations, or a group of tribal nations, the responsibility to administer Medicare and Medicaid services on their own. For larger nations, that may be an option, but for smaller tribes, like the Piscataway Kanoi, it's probably not feasible. Jesse Swan is their chief.
I don't know if we're able to take full advantage of that at this point in time. You know, you're controlling a large amount of money, and the state's been doing it, and you know, trying to step into that right now would be add more to the plate, you know.
At this point, cuts to Medicare and Medicaid are included in the president's budget, but congressional Democrats are promising to block them. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
An international e-commerce retailer has relisted items that a Juneau, Alaska resident crafted from sea otter fur. It happened after the Alaska Native artist petitioned Etsy to relist the items, and U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan exchanged some letters with the company. KTOO's Trip Krause looks into the marketplace's policy and how it conflicts with a federal exemption to allow Alaska Natives to sell certain crafts.
Etsy says it's moving away from local and national laws, such as the U.S. Endangered Species Act, and toward international standards. Those standards don't include an exemption for Alaska Native artists. So the company says it removed ivory items from its website. Items made from endangered species, such as some populations of sea otters, were also removed. Marcus Goh is Inupiaq Eskimo. He hunts sea otters in southeast Alaska and uses the pelts to create scarves, gloves, vests, and other items. He heard of Etsy delisting other artists' items and reached out to his customer service representative out of concern. That's when the representative noticed his sea otter items.
After a while, she told me that because sea otters were endangered, my items would be delisted. And then this confused, and it got me a little bit frustrated because they're not. We have so many sea otters here.
He petitioned Etsy, saying that the population of southeast sea otters aren't endangered, and eventually his items were relisted. That was good news for U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan's office and spokesman Matt Shekaro.
The senator and also the office are hopeful that we can find a, a positive solution for those that may not have been able to relist their items, and we can find some resolution for those artisans.
Earlier this month, the Alaska Republican had sent a letter to Etsy following reports of walrus ivory and sea otter items being delisted from the online retailer. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation.
Trump today doubled down on his claim that he will arm teachers in response to the mass shooting in Florida last week. But a new report using Bureau of Justice statistics has shown that arming teachers presents a new set of risks and does not help in mass shooting incidents. Similar arguments were put forward by the gun lobby following the 1999 massacre at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, even though armed personnel were present at Columbine but were outgunned by the teen attackers. Nationally, guns are rarely used to kill criminals or stop crimes. The 2017 Violence Policy Center study reveals that private citizens use guns to harm themselves or others far more often than to justifiably kill in self-defense.
Execution drugs are getting harder and harder for penitentiary systems to obtain. Pharmacy companies simply don't want to sell their products for that purpose or face the public outcry if they did. However, Missouri found a way to circumnavigate the bad press and still maintain the ability to increase its executions. As reported in BuzzFeed, their drug of choice, pentobarbital, had been stockpiled before their previous pharmacy dropped them. This stockpile enabled them to execute one person each month for over a year. Since 2014, no one has been able to find out just who the new supplier is. The truth revealed by BuzzFeed showed what they are calling cloak and dagger techniques to obtain pentobarbital. With only a few high-level employees from the Department of Corrections knowing the name of the distributing pharmacy, which was referred to only by its codename M7. These high-ranking employees would regularly have clandestine meetings before executions and would exchange envelopes full of money in exchange for four vials of the drug. That is more than twice the required amount. David Dormeyer, the second in command at the Missouri Department of Corrections, would go to these meetings alone in order to maintain the anonymity of the pharmaceutical company called Foundation Care. The secrecy involved in this exchange breaks Missouri's anti-fraud laws, as well as its requirement to have a witness at such exchanges. And, as also reported in BuzzFeed, the secrecy in obtaining execution drugs often leads to botched executions that can lead to long, painful deaths in inmates, which most certainly violates the Eighth Amendment, no cruel or unusual punishment. The company, Foundation Care, already has a speckled history in several pending lawsuits, one involving a patient getting pneumonia from their drugs. The FDA labeled them a high-risk pharmacy after finding subpar practices that could lead to, quote, that could lead to contamination of drugs, potentially putting patients at risk. And a lawsuit from a former employee who complained of serious operational violations and then was fired shortly afterwards. In a direct quote from BuzzFeed about their investigation, "It is unclear whether Missouri Pharmacy Board took steps to oversee Foundation Care because the state refused to turn over inspection records to BuzzFeed News. But on the very day the FDA warned Missouri about the company, executioners injected Foundation Care's drugs into a death row inmate," end quote. Since the printing of their article yesterday, Foundation Care's parent company, Centene, has said that the pharmacy will no longer provide execution drugs to the state.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2004. That was the day Secretary of Education Rod Page stated that he considered the National Education Association to be a terrorist organization. He made the remarks during a meeting with governors who were visiting the White House. His apology a few hours later was just as inflammatory. There he expressed his frustration at the, quote, obstructionist scare tactics the NEA's Washington lobbyists have employed against No Child Left Behind's historic reforms. Representing almost 3 million educators, the NEA had been fighting many aspects of the No Child Left Behind Act passed by Congress in 2001. The teachers' unions had initially supported the measure, but they came to realize that the act was designed to undermine public education in favor of charter, private, and religious schools. No Child Left Behind mandated regular standardized testing of students. It also threatened financial penalties and school closures. Governors on board with the goals of the act soon grew frustrated. The Bush administration reneged on federal funding necessary for its implementation. The union movement was outraged at Page's smear. John Sweeney, then president of the AFL-CIO, said, quote, the Bush administration would like to label all those who disagree with it as terrorists in order to cover up its policies, which are harmful to working families and to divert attention from its inability to create good jobs. By 2015, the No Child Left Behind Act had received so much criticism from every corner that the Every Student Succeeds Act replaced it. This act retains Common Core standards but transfers school accountability to the states. It is now pending review under President Donald Trump's Regulatory Freeze Directive. In 2017, it was pending review under President Donald Trump's Regulatory Freeze Directive.
Climate Connections is a daily podcast about how climate change is affecting our lives. Today's episode examines the relationship between Christianity and climate change.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Sharon Delgado is a retired United Methodist minister and activist who challenges Christians to reflect on how their faith relates to climate change. In her new book, Love in a Time of Climate Change, Delgado uses scripture and religious teachings to explain why Christian ideals require action on global warming.
It's not simply an issue of loving the earth and taking care of the earth. It's also an issue of standing up and speaking out for justice for people who are on the front lines of climate change.
She says that includes poor and vulnerable people who often bear the brunt of extreme weather, droughts, and pollution, as well as children and future generations.
Love of God and neighbor means that we have to honor creation and care for it, and we have to establish justice.
For Delgado, that means going beyond individual actions like recycling. She encourages Christians to become politically active and to speak out in support of climate-friendly laws and policies.
We're facing a living hell on earth if we don't turn things around, and that is going to require systemic change.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Our genetic cousins, the Neanderthals, have often been viewed as our intellectual inferiors that were outpaced by a more sophisticated species after having the whole of Europe at their dragging fingertips. However, evidence has shown that they took care when burying the dead and were able to mend bones and care for their injured. Now even newer evidence is showing that they had an artistic side with the discovery of 65,000-year-old cave paintings in Spain, as well as seashell beads, the earliest evidence of self-adornment. What makes this discovery so significant is that it predates the arrival of humans by 20,000 years. Alistair Pike, one of the co-authors of the study, told Reuters, quote, what we've got here is a smoking gun that really overturns the notion that Neanderthals were knuckle-dragging cavemen, end quote. The discovery happened after the co-authors of the study, Jaume Zilliau and Alistair Pike, met an anthropologist that specialized in dating minerals. In three of the cave paintings, they were able to prove that the mineral pigments used in the paintings were at least 64,800 years old, and could quite possibly be much older.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Teresa Mitchell, Sam Bowman, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Jasmine Moneymaker. Our engineers have been Team Yankee, including Aaron Yankee and Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani talks with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz about her new book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. At 9, One Land, Many Voices explores political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine and Israel. At 10, Valley View's host Dale Holliday looks at the debate around the Sunflower House Cultural Center in Corvallis. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with the host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Pacific Underground, a show for and by Asian and Pacific Islander communities. KBOO is a listener-supported community radio. Help KBOO build a city of media makers. Contribute to our Kickstarter campaign. Find out more at information at kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Il Camille and Fritzois, Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Tonic Lounge in Portland. From Los Angeles, MC Il Camille's divine mission is to uplift the world through Heirloom, her latest record. Fritzois' latest, the self-written and produced Avenue A, is filled with a soul-drenched sound that doesn't quite sit in a neat box of influences. The night also includes DJ sets by DJ Black Daria and DJ Shishi of Everyday Mixtapes. This is a 21 and over event. Again, that's Il Camille and Fritzois, Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is reporter Al Cohen for the KBOO Evening News. KBOO News maintains a credibility grounded in real reporting and visionary human rights movements. Last year, KBOO News covered increases in illegal ICE sweeps and no zones for public transit-dependent immigrants. When the city shook from the rise of hate crimes in Oregon last year, KBOO News formed an investigative team and were the only media outlet covering the DOJ settlement on excessive use of force in Portland. KBOO News continues a dedication to looking out for you and making Portland's media count. When you become a member of KBOO, your funds go toward making a city full of media makers who will broadcast the stories that matter most to you.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Renowned author Ursula K. Le Guin was known for more than just her books in fantasy and science fiction. She was also a critical voice in the literary world. Her insights into the publishing industry and censorship are shared here in a 1988 talk recorded at the Northwest Women's Studies Conference at Portland State University. Ursula K. Le Guin passed away 1 month ago on January 22, 2018, at the age of 88.
If you're a science fiction or fantasy fan, then Ursula K. Le Guin has no doubt had a place on your bookshelves. For over 60 years, Le Guin was an overwhelming influence and was often described as one of the best science fiction writers to grace the genre. Here she is speaking at the Northwest Women's Studies Conference at Portland State University in 1988, discussing censorship, creativity, and being one of the first women published in Playboy in 1968.
I don't know of a case in which any of my books has been banned or censored. I know that it has happened that there are school districts in this country where my books and a whole lot of others from Mark Twain on, you know, have been taken off the reading list. But, you know, I don't know of an actual case. Most authors don't. It just comes to their attention. The first time anything of mine was banned, it was my first name. My agent sold a story of mine to Playboy in 1968. And she submitted it as by U.K. Le Guin, and I didn't have a name yet. Left Hand of Darkness hadn't come out. I published some stories and science fiction novels, but I was not a name, you know. And so here comes a story by U.K. Le Guin, Ulysses or something, you know, and they accepted it. And they offered $2,000 for it, which even now is good pay, and in 68, you can imagine, you know. So we signed the contract. And then Playboy was informed with some glee by my female agent that my first name was Ursula. And they sort of panicked, and they wrote us a letter saying, we would like to publish this story with the initials as you submitted it, because many of our readers are frightened by stories by women. And as a matter of fact, at that time, there had been one story by a woman ever published in Playboy. That was the little French woman that sucked her thumb. A very pretty girl. I can't think of her name. Anyway, I was the second woman ever published by Playboy, but I was not published as a woman. I accepted this in 1968. I would not, of course, now. I'm sorry I did. But my consciousness wasn't raised. I thought it was funny. And it is funny. The trouble is it's also significant. So, anyway, I thought I would read one paragraph from the story that Playboy published, Nine Lives, which has been enormously republished. And this kind of fits in with something I'll be coming back around to at the end. Now, this little paragraph I'm going to read, you don't have to know anything except that Owen Pugh is they're on a alien planet. There's a very few of them. There's really just two guys there, and then a clone comes. 10 people, 5 male, 5 female, who have all been cloned from one individual. So they are closer than identical twins. They are, as it were, 10 versions of the same person, but they come in two sexes. So. From his sleeping bag, Pugh watched the clones awakening. They all got up within 1 minute, except for one pair, a boy and a girl, who lay snugly tangled and still sleeping in one bag. As Pugh saw this, there was a shock like one of Libra's earthquakes inside him, a very deep tremor. He wasn't aware of this, and in fact thought he was pleased at the sight. There was no other such comfort on this dead, hollow world. More power to them who made love. One of the others stepped on the pair. They woke, and the girl sat up, flushed and sleepy, with bare golden breasts. One of her sisters murmured something to her. She shot a glance at Pugh and disappeared into the sleeping bag. From another direction came a fierce stare. From still another direction, a voice. Oh, Christ, we're used to having a room to ourselves. I hope you don't mind, Captain Pugh. It's a pleasure, Pugh said, half truthfully. You see, Owen Pugh, he's a Welshman and fairly conservative, and he's shocked by incest. Playboy isn't. Nobody is. We don't censor incest. Okay, now the next time I was again asked to censor myself. I refused. I had come a long way. It was 1975. And I was writing, it was a talk I gave up in Seattle, and then it was going to be reprinted in a magazine I like a lot, Science Fiction Studies, very respectable science fiction magazine, edited by a very good friend of mine, Darko Suvin, a Marxist, socialist, not a liberal, a radical. Well, I will read you the first paragraph and the last couple of paragraphs, and then I will tell you about the censorship. The piece is called American Science Fiction and the Other, and it's in Language of the Night. One of the great early socialists said that the status of women in a society is a pretty reliable index of the degree of civilization of that society. If this is true, then the very low status of women in science fiction should make us ponder about whether science fiction is civilized at all. Then I talk about, you know, the squeaking heroine and the heroine to whom, the girl to whom everything is explained, you know, and all these, remember, this is 75. Science fiction has come away from there. And I ended up, in general, American science fiction has assumed a permanent hierarchy of superiors and inferiors, with rich, ambitious, aggressive males at the top, then a great gap, and at the bottom, the poor, the uneducated, the faceless masses, and old women. The whole picture is, if I may say so, curiously, quote-unquote, un-American. It is a perfect baboon patriarchy, with the alpha male on top being respectfully groomed from time to time by his inferiors. Is this speculation? Is this imagination? Is this extrapolation? I call it brainless regressivism. I think it's time science fiction writers and their readers stopped daydreaming about a return to the age of Queen Victoria and started thinking about the future. I would like to see the baboon ideal replaced by a little human idealism and some serious consideration of such deeply radical futuristic concepts as liberty, equality, and fraternity. And remember that about 53% of the brotherhood of man is the sisterhood of woman. My editor said, it's a great piece, you know, we want it. The last sentence seems superfluous. Could you cut it? I said, no. This time I knew when to say no and why I was being asked. It takes a while. If Huck could learn, so can I. Okay, now, coming to Lathe of Heaven, which is a more recent event, I wrote a little piece for the Oregonian, which was published, that was in 1984, that they had this hearing in Washougal. I was told about it just the night before it happened by a librarian at the school who, I think to whom it suddenly occurred, the author lives nearby and ought to know about this. Otherwise, you see, I never would have known anything about it, and this is why I am morally certain that my books, along with practically everybody else's who write seriously, have been banned over and over and over by librarians under pressure and by school teachers and school boards under pressure. The hearing was very interesting, and my forthcoming book, Dancing at the Edge of the World, which is a bunch of essays and talks and stuff, has that piece from the Oregonian, so I will read just a little about it. The case against the book was presented first at this hearing in Washougal. The man who was asking that it be withdrawn stated his objections to the following elements in the book. I noted these down, see, at the time. Fuzzy thinking and poor sentence structure. That one hurt. Oh, that made me madder than almost anything else. A mention of homosexuality. A character who keeps a flask of brandy in her purse and who remarks that her mother did not love her. He talked about this just a little bit. I found his sentence structure a little hard to follow, to tell you the truth. But can I stop? Oh, hallelujah. Yeah. He said it was demoralizing to kids or something. He had sort of argument there. And then it seemed curious to me that he didn't mention the fact that this same character is a black woman whose lover slash husband at different times is a white man. I had the feeling that this was really what he hated in the book, but he was afraid to say so, but that was only my feeling. He also took exception to what he described as the author's advocacy of non-Christian religions. I never advocated no religion. And or of non-separation of church and state. His arguments on this point or these points were not clear to me. Finally, during discussion, he compared the book to junk food because it was science fiction. The English department of the school then presented a carefully prepared, spirited defense of the book, including statements by students who had read it. Some of them liked it, some of them didn't. Most objected to having it or any other book banned. In discussion, teachers pointed out that since it is the policy of the Washougal School District to assign an alternative book to any student who objects on any grounds to reading an assigned one, the attempt to prevent a whole class from reading a book was an attempt to change policy, replacing free choice by censorship. When the Instructional Materials Committee of the district voted on the motion to ban the book, the motion was defeated 20-5. The hearing was public and was conducted in the most open and democratic fashion. I didn't speak, as I felt the teachers and students had spoken eloquently for me. What was really going on, as far as I could figure it out, was not so much an attempt to ban one book. This was just one book among many. It was an attempt to change policy. And probably it was an attack on this freedom that the Washougal District, and I think most Washington school districts, have of that the student can't object. And therefore, you see, it makes it almost impossible to ban a book. It's a lovely policy. I recommend it to all school districts. Okay, now, here's poor old Lathe of Heaven. I'm really surprised that there are 20. And I was looking for one and I couldn't find one. I wanted to find Heather, the woman saying, when I know she's the swearingest person in the book, but anyway, I couldn't find that, so I picked out what I feel is the sexiest part of this book. This is Le Guin being steamy. Now, at the moment, we can't object to black-white because at the moment, both these people are gray. I'm not going to try to explain this book, believe me. And what's more, they're married. George was a more urgent consideration. She was holding him as he held her. "You're worn out," she said. "You're upset. You fell asleep on the floor. It's that bastard, Habert. Don't go back to him. Just don't. I don't care what he does. We'll take it to court. We'll appeal it. Even if he slaps a constraint injunction on you and sticks you in Linton, we'll get you a different shrink and get you out again. You can't go on with him. He's destroying you." "Nobody can destroy me," he said, and laughed a little deep in his chest, almost a sob. "Not so long as I have a little help from my friend. I'll go back. It's not going to last much longer. It's not me I'm worried about anymore, but don't worry." They hung on to each other, in touch at all available surfaces, absolutely unified, while the liver and onions sizzled in the pan. "I fell asleep too," she said into his neck. I got so groggy typing up old Ruddy's dumb letters. But that's a good record you bought. I loved the Beatles when I was a kid, but the government stations never play them anymore. It was a present, George said, but the liver popped in the pan and she had to disengage herself and see to it. At dinner, George watched her. She watched him a good bit, too. They had been married 7 months. They said nothing of any importance. They washed up the dishes and went to bed. In bed, they made love. Love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made like bread. Remade all the time, made new. When it was made, they lay in each other's arms, holding love, asleep. In her sleep, Heather heard the roaring of a creek, full of the voices of unborn children singing.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 30 seconds to 6 o'clock. You can hear the rest of that lecture of Ursula K. Le Guin on our website. Just go to kboo.fm. Coming up next is Rose City Native Radio. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include 76 and The Footprints of Pan-Africanism and more at the Hollywood Theater, and The African Who Wanted to Fly, Foreign Bodies, Wulu, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 20th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to the Fire campaign peaceful protest on Wednesday, February 28th at 10 a.m. at the Clackamas County.